Wake up, podcast listener, and welcome back, movie lovers, to another electrifying episode of the Silver Screen Podcast. I am your regular host, or one of your regular hosts, Mike. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the ever-insightful DK.
Hello.
Hello there. And we're joined by two very special guests for this one, returning guests you probably haven't heard from in a while. First of all, taking on the role of our operator, Tank for this episode. Welcome back, Glenn. Welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Hello there. And potentially stepping into the role of the kick-ass Trinity, welcome back, Angela.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello there. And we definitely haven't recorded this once already that didn't work. Don't worry about it. Today, we are celebrating a milestone in cinematic history as we commemorate the 25th anniversary of a film that redefined the genre, The Matrix, as if you hadn't guessed. To mark this special occasion, we're breaking down, dissecting, and reviewing every aspect of this groundbreaking movie, from revolutionary special effects to deep philosophical questions. The Matrix has left an indelible mark on film and pop culture. So take the red pill, not in that way, and join us as we dive into Wonderland, unraveling the layers of this iconic film. Get ready for an in-depth discussion that will make you see The Matrix in a whole new light. Let's plug in and start the journey. But before we go any further, this is a fairly obvious spoiler alert. Now, I know this film is 25 years old, but we're going to be peeling back the onion here to examine everything in depth, and you really should watch the movie before going any deeper with us. After all, nobody can be told what The Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. So, with that out of the way, I'm going to jump into the first thing that we almost always do on these podcasts, which is to just go around and ask everybody's kind of first experience with The Matrix, how it first hit you, if you can remember. And I'm going to come to you first, Glenn. Do you remember the first time you saw this?
I do. There was a program on ITV, late early morning, that used to feature American top 10 trailers. It and watch it the morning after, and they showed the trailer for The Matrix, and I could not believe what I was seeing. I must have rewound, played it a dozen times before I left for work, and I was working in a place called The Last Picture Show in Meadowhall, and I went in and I was kind of like just shaking. And it was like, guys, you have to see this amazing trailer. You've got to see this incredible new film that's coming out. And they all went, wow, who's in it? And I went, Keanu Reeves. And they all went, no, definitely not. No, can't be any good. Keanu Reeves is in it. It's going to suck. Quickly opened an issue of Starlog, the latest sci-fi magazine, American Import.
Nice.
And there was one picture of Keanu holding an M16 dressed in black with the shades on. And it was just like incredible. Then, of course, I went to see the first showing at Meadowhall View Entertainment, and it was just incredible. Just couldn't believe what I was seeing. It's just an incredible experience to see that for the first time when there was nothing remotely like it. It's almost indescribable how good it was.
Cool.
I just saw that track. I must have rewound and played it maybe a dozen times before I left the house to go to work because I could not believe what my eyes were showing me. I was instantly in, completely and utterly in.
Awesome. Cool. Fair enough. So what about you, Angela? Similar experience or not?
Well, I was a fan of Bill and Ted. So when I heard Keanu Reeves was going to be in it, I was like, yeah, absolutely. So it can't have been me you were talking to about it, Glenn, because I'd have gone, straight away.
I don't think it was Angela, no. It was a couple of the guys, I'm sure.
Yeah, because obviously I worked in the same place as Glenn and DK.
Oh, right.
Many years ago, if you remember.
Right.
I'm just trying to think.
Not long enough, I still have the dreams.
I went to see it in the same place. In view because we didn't have the rival one in Sheffield at the time. I think when I came out of the cinema after watching it, to quote Ted Theodore Logan, whoa.
Nice. So you equally were just kind of like, wow, kind of hit you like a freight train, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I really love sci-fi anyway, as DK will definitely confirm, but
Oh, yes.
It was just amazing. It, I mean, just the graphics, you know, it was,
yeah,
and the dystopian future. It was like, yeah, this is really cool.
And DK, I haven't actually asked you this, so what about you?
I was probably one of the people that Glenn showed this to and went, nah, dude.
I think you might have been, yes.
Yeah, because I, you know, other than Bill and Ted, I wasn't that impressed with Keanu's resume at that point. Mm. So when it must have been Glenn. When Glenn showed it me,
I think so.
I was just like, really, really not sure. And kind of wrote it off. I saw Johnny Mnemonic. That's probably one of the reasons why I wrote that off. And then I went to the cinema not knowing anything really about it. And it wasn't the same cinema, but I was just blown away.
Awesome. I have really vivid memories of seeing this, which is weird because it doesn't often happen with movies. I was with my friend and we were at the local Blyth Cinema, which isn't there anymore. And I just remember it not really... nobody really knowing what to expect. And I remember vividly being in one of the like smaller screening rooms, because it wasn't really, I think, proposed or expected to be a blockbuster or something that was huge. I'd had seen like it was starting to make the rounds in marketing and on the TV, but even that was kind of all the marketing I saw was just basically around the mystery. It was kind of, as I alluded to up top, it was all like, you can't be told what it is. You've got to see it for yourself. And I was like, oh, what's that? So, yeah, and plus all the hype at the time was all around, like, Phantom Menace and what have you. So I remember seeing it at the cinema on a slightly smaller screen than I probably should have, because it was, you know, like I said, nobody knew what to expect at first. And I just didn't really know what to think at first coming out of it, because it was so different to anything that I'd seen. And like I said, I went in with zero expectations and was just like, I remember... just thinking a lot about it, perhaps because of the, like, philosophical undercurrents and stuff, and trying to think, get my head around like what it was trying to say and stuff. But I do recall it was something I wanted to watch again, and I was immediately like, I need to watch that again. There's too much to take in one viewing. But like everyone else, I was just kind of like, the special effects, the use of bullet time and stuff for the very first time, I was like, that's going to be an absolute game changer. This reminds me of the first time we watched like Terminator 2 and saw the morphing effects and stuff. So I knew that was going to be like imitated everywhere for the next 20 years, probably. So yeah, that was my experience with it.
And you weren't wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Everything from a scary movie to, I don't know, the actual Matrix sequels, I guess. So yeah, we'll start out of the way. Then we tend to move on to our behind the scenes sections, just to give you a bit of background on the film. And there's a lot when it comes to this film. So DK, as usual, I've tasked you with handling this. So...
I've just got like the little production notes at the moment, and then I'll liberally sprinkle some you know, neckbeard shit in as we go.
And I've got quite a lot anyway, so I'll probably pick up anything you haven't got. Said before we came on audience, I did let everyone know that my dissertation was on machine tech in sci-fi cinema, and my whole last chapter was on the Matrix. So I know way too much about this and couldn't stop writing about it. So yeah, apologies for that in advance. But yeah, go ahead, take it away.
Yeah, it's Matrix is a 1999 science fiction action film written and directed by the Wachowskis. It's the first installment, or the standalone, if you're Glenn, in the Matrix film series, yes, starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, Carrie-Anne Moss, Hugo Weaving, and Joe Pantoliano. No, Joey Pants. And depicts a dystopian future in which humanity is unknowingly trapped inside the Matrix, a simulated reality that intelligent machines have created to distract humans while using their bodies as an energy source. And I'm just ruined it for everybody that's not seen it. But if you're coming into this episode, it's your own fault. When computer programmer Thomas Anderson, under the hacker alias Neo, uncovers the truth, he joins a rebellion against the machines, along with other people who have been freed from the Matrix. Now, the Wachowskis' approach to action scenes was influenced by anime and martial arts films, particularly fight choreographers and wire fu techniques from Hong Kong action cinema. Other influences include Plato's Cave and 1990s Telnet hacker communities. The film popularized terms such as the red pill, which has since been co-opted by fucking idiots, and introduced a visual effect known as bullet time, in which the heightened perception of certain characters is represented by allowing the action within a shot to progress in slow motion while the camera appears to move through the scene at normal speed, allowing the sped-up movements of certain characters to be perceived normally. It opened in theatres in the US on March the 31st, 1999, to widespread acclaim from critics who praised its innovative special effects, action sequence, cinematography, and entertainment value. It was also a box office success, grossing over $460 million on a $63 million budget, becoming the highest-grossing Warner Brothers film of 1999 and the fourth highest-grossing film of that year. It received nominations at the 72nd Academy Awards for Best Visual Effects, Best Film Editing, Best Sound, and Best Sound Editing, winning all four categories. It was also the recipient of numerous other accolades, including Best Sound and Best Special Visual Effects at the 53rd British Academy Film Awards, and the Wachowskis were awarded Best Director and Best Science Fiction Film at the 26th Saturn Awards. The Matrix is considered to be among the greatest science fiction films of all time, and in 2012, take a drink, folks, the film was selected for preservation in the US state's National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant.
Yay!
the film's success led to two feature film sequels being released in 2003, Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions, which were also written and directed by the Wachowskis. The Matrix franchise was further expanded through the production of comic books, video games, and an animated anthology film, The Animatrix, with which the Wachowskis were heavily involved. The franchise has also inspired books and theories, expanding on some of the religious and philosophical ideas alluded to in the films. And a fourth movie, The Matrix Resurrections, was released in 2020.
Glenn was not a fan, apparently.
Please, don't mention it. Oh my god, oh no, 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 no.
Sorry, DK. That's all I've got. So, yeah, thank you for providing the sound effects for my finishing.
Ah, man, we'll have to talk about these another time. I'm not going to get into the sequels because we'll be here forever, and there's enough here, but yeah. Suffice to say, we won't be able to get into everything about this film, or we really will be here forever. There's many places you can go for in-depth explorations, and the film really is worth it, in my opinion. Suffice to say, it packs in a lot. Religion, philosophy, gender identity, individual autonomy, explorations of virtual reality, artificial intelligence, human consciousness, and more. It takes influence from many places, some of which DK has said, but also exploring themes from cyberpunk legends like William Gibson to philosophers like Descartes and so much more besides. So with that said, we kind of already are scraping this area, so we'll probably move into the writing, talk about the writing of the film. Is there anything in particular amongst all of these many things that stands out to any of you as, you know, as something that, I don't know, spoke to you maybe the first time you saw The Matrix, or that immediately sort of stuck in your brain? And Glenn, I'll come to you first again. Why not?
Well, basically anything Agent Smith says. Anything that comes out, of his mouth, basically, is incredibly memorable.
I don't think you're supposed to relate to him, but okay.
I relate to both Cypher and him incredibly, especially Cypher wanting to get put back into the Matrix. Because he's so dissatisfied with reality, he wants to go back where life could be perfect. Yeah, I can relate to both of them, both Smith and him.
So you're basically you're relating to Satan villains. And Judas, then.
to the villains of the piece, basically. Yeah. I mean, there's so much memorable dialogue. I mean, as you said, there's so many philosophical exchanges. All the quotable stuff, like the really famous stuff's already, you know, it's been used so many times. You know, there is no spoon and all this kind of stuff. But I really do find the Smith's dialogue incredible. The dialogue where he's torturing Morpheus, interrogating him. He sends the other two agents out of the room, and he then tells him that, you know, humanity is a virus and a cancer. And he can't stand the smell of the place. All he wants to do is get out. I think Smith's dialogue is just wonderful. I love Hugo Weaving.
Watching that back now, it's amazing how much that actually sets up the sequels, which at the time I didn't really realize, because it's kind of like Smith isn't even like with the agents. He's just kind of he's renegade even to them. He's like, no, I just want out of here. I hate this place. You know,
he becomes autonomous. He becomes functioning within himself, which is incredible, seeing as he's supposedly just part of the big program.
Gets his own individual the themes. Yeah, the whole idea of like AI gone rogue and gone wrong, and you give it sentience, what point does it stop, as you said? And would you be able to ever control it? You know, so
the AI goes rogue from the AI.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
Because it's all about chaos and control, obviously, is the idea. But you alluded to the kind of the spoon boy, the idea of like he's dressed very kind of Buddhist, and I think some of those philosophies I'm not that familiar with, but it seems to be very much, you know, it's a Buddhist kind of way of looking at life, as like, oh, nothing's meaningful, it doesn't matter, it's not really here, life is a dream, I guess, or whatever. So yeah, some interesting things to pick up on for sure. But again, I won't go into them too heavily.
Oh, so many.
I don't want to be here forever. So what about you, Anne?
I think a lot of it for me is to do with identity, the self-identity, you know, not just visually, because you see how Neo is in the real world and how he projects himself in the Matrix, as do the other characters, but also the perception of who you are and what you can be, what you can achieve, you know, and others' perceptions of you. So obviously the other characters were looking at Neo as his savior, and he's there going, well, I'm not who you think I am. You know, it's the way that you deal with people's perceptions of you and your own perceptions as well.
And that boils down to that line from Morpheus, doesn't it? Which is, you know, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path, which, you know, it's another thinker, but it kind of sums up the way Neo kind of gets told, oh, you're not the one. Sorry, kid. You may be waiting for your next life, which, again, kind of subtle foreshadowing of the fact that he dies and comes back. But yeah. I'll come to you first, DK, before I get into like some of the things that that affected me. What specific particularly spoke to you from the writing of the various things in the film?
Again, it was it's like Angela brings up. I do love the posits on identity, how you perceive yourself, in, you know, what you think is the real world, what eventually turns out to not be the real world. And I find it interesting on the level of the Wachowskis themselves, because as obviously they're both transgender, and the allusions to that. I like the fact that originally the character of Switch was supposed to be played by a male in the real world, and the Avatar was supposed to be obviously female. They went with,
hence the name,
you know, yeah. Hence the name. Obviously they went with, you know, Belinda McClory in the end, and kind of gave her an androgynous look. But I think it would have been a lot better had they followed with the original plan, because, you know, there are a lot of comparisons to video games and things like that. So it would have been nice to see an Avatar represented as a different sex. Maybe the audience at that point wasn't particularly ready for it, but well, I do like how in the Matrix you can perceive yourself how idealistically you would like to be, and I think that would have hammered that point home a lot more.
Yeah, I would have liked to see a little bit more difference, as opposed to, I mean, you can't deny that it affected pop culture, and there's something undeniably cool about the fact that they're all in, you know, black PVC or leather with cool ass sunglasses and whatever. But you'd think you would change a little bit more than that. I mean, other than that, they all look basically the same. It's just their clothes that are changing. So I might have preferred that. But the first thing that I actually had written was basically about that, DK. You've kind of covered half of what I was going to say, which is that one of the things that spoke to me, and it does quite a lot in sci-fi, is this idea of feeling like there's something wrong with the world, that you don't fit in, which again is a general idea that, you know, we've dealt with in sci-fi a lot, and that's, you know, a lot of us nerds have felt like that in various ways. But now it is very specifically tied to gender identity because, as you said, of the transition of the Wachowski sisters. And Morpheus's description of the Matrix creating a sense of something wrong, like a splinter in your mind, has apparently been compared to gender dysphoria. Keanu Reeves has said that the Matrix Avatar would have been a different sex than Zion reality in the early draft of the script for everyone. which I didn't know, but the studio wasn't ready for that version. The red pill's been compared with red estrogen pills. And as you said, Switch was originally going to change gender. Eventually was what they settled on, but that didn't end up happening either. So I know there's a lot of people that complain about this reading because they don't want it to apply to, you know, gender dysphoria and things, but given the creators of this world and that they have since come out and said that, like, yeah, whether it was conscious or otherwise, they were clearly looking at this through a lens of not being in the right body or feeling like the right gender, and that, you know, feeds into everything. Like, identity is, as you said, a huge part of the Matrix, this residual self-image. Or, you know, do you feel like you're fulfilled? Do you feel right, I guess, in your own self?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be about gender either.
No.
You know yourself. Well, I mean, maybe not so much you, because you're not so much a video game player. But, you know, there are people out there that log into World of Warcraft, and with the best will in the world, their avatars do not look like, you know. I did find it interesting that in an online interview when the film was released, both Wachowskis revealed that they would take the blue pill if given Neo's choice.
Yeah, yeah. Which is ironic, because then in life they both took the red pill later, so kind of proving themselves wrong. Yeah, but fair enough. So the next thing I wanted to talk about briefly then was the kind of social commentary aspects, which we've touched on. The idea of, like, technology and control, you know, technology has enslaved humanity because of the potential dangers of unchecked growth, and the depiction of AI as a dominant controlling force, which, as we keep saying when we talk about these sci-fi films, is more and more prevalent. You know, it's taken away your privacy in kind of allusions to 1984 and things. It's surveilling you everywhere. You know, so is this something that you were aware of when you first watched the film, guys? And I'll open it up to everybody. Were you kind of aware of this history in sci-fi of, like, you know, forewarning about technology and being a sort of... you know, a roadmap of what not to do that we keep ignoring?
Well, that's been kind of there since Metropolis, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, so, yeah,
yeah,
that was literally my dissertation. But yeah, exactly. It was called From Metropolis to the Matrix, just in case anybody ever finds it anywhere. So yeah, no, that's what I think. what about you, Glenn and Angela? Did you kind of pick up on any of this, or was it more of a kind of a later discovery for you?
I think for me, it was a later one. Yeah, I mean, I've seen films like 2001, A Space Odyssey. So you've got HAL. You've got the forewarnings about technology going rogue from there. And it's only in later years that you sort of draw parallels when you watch them back again and go, oh, yeah. You know, things dawn on you that don't necessarily occur to you at the time, you know. When I go to a film, I don't really dissect it there and then. It's usually afterwards when I'm walking back again. You know, that's other, you know, I'll pick out various points from that. I'm like, right, I see that now.
Absolutely. But it's like you said, I think it's kind of hard to deny. It's like, as much as The Matrix is unique in a lot of ways, it's a part of this lineage of sci-fi that tries to warn us about stuff that goes from, like, the Terminator movies or HAL, Demon Seed, Metropolis. Even we've just looked at Alien, like Ash in the first Alien movie, you know, technology that's gone wrong, has no respect for life. So it is definitely something I think that's there. Did you pick up on that, Glenn?
Not really. I just took it as an action adventure film, really. I got my kind of like technology taken over from Terminator. That was the one that said, whoa, just a second, you know, intelligent machines getting too intelligent, then taking over. And it was the Terminator that hammered that point home for me. I only kind of like got that message when you saw the field of human batteries. Mm-hmm. I saw it as an action film until that one scene when it shows that complete field of human batteries, and then went, ooh, now that is not good. Is that what we're going to end up as, human batteries?
Absolutely. But for me, one of the things that kind of reinforced it for me as very similar to this Terminator plot, it's actually a line from Agent Smith, so you'll appreciate it. It's when he says that, you know, we made the Matrix to resemble, it resembled 1999 because that was the peak of your society. And I call it your society because, of course, when we started thinking for you, it effectively became our society. And it's kind of like, well, shit, that's exactly where we're heading. Like, oh, you can do the thinking for us. Nope, probably not wise.
Oh, yeah. Anything that comes out of Agent Smith's mouth is golden.
But yeah, I mean, related to the technology stuff, obviously this film, it fits into the kind of techno-noir, cyberpunk kind of computers thing. Certainly it was very popular in the 90s. You had things like the aforementioned Johnny Mnemonic that we talked about off air, that Keanu Reeves had already starred in, or things like The Net, or I think Existenz. Although I've never actually seen that, but I have a feeling it looks like it's one of those type of movies.
It's worth it just for Christopher Eccleston's American accent. It's getting the Americans back for Dick Van Dyke.
That is going on the list. So yeah, I mean, to kind of reinforce that, in case you're sitting there thinking, I don't know, what do you mean by this? Well, Neo is often associated with the number one because it's an anagram for one, and a major plot point, of course, is whether or not he is the one, which ties into the religious allegory and stuff as well. Meanwhile, Cypher's name means zero from the Arabic Sifr. And together, 0 and 1 represent the basis of binary data and thus the basis of all modern computer data. Neo also lives in apartment 101, a number composed entirely of those two digits. And finally, Trinity, as well as being an allusion to the Holy Trinity, also means group of three, and she first appears in room 303. So, lots of things just...
I also find that room 101 is kind of the purgatory.
From 1984. Yeah.
Yeah, he's essentially living in purgatory when it starts.
Absolutely, that's the kind of point. And yeah, speaking of, because again, we're kind of touching on this, it draws into the kind of philosophical aspects of the movie. As you mentioned, the film draws heavily from Plato's allegory of the cave, which, if you're not aware, is the idea of mistaking shadows for reality, kind of fitting in this case. It also plays to Descartes' skepticism, the idea of I think, therefore I am, and importantly, Baudrillard's simulacra and simulation, which is actually the book where Neo hides his various whatever it is that he's giving the people that come knocking on the door. The cast were required to be able to understand and explain The Matrix, and French philosopher Beauregard's simulacra and simulation, as mentioned, was required reading for most of the principal cast and crew. In early 1997, the Wachowskis had Reeves read Simulacra and Simulation, Kevin Kelly's Out of Control, The New Biology of Machines, Social Systems and the Economic World, and Dylan Evans's Ideas on Evolutionary Psychology, even before they opened up the script. And eventually he was able to explain all the philosophical nuances involved. No, honestly. And Carrie-Anne Moss commented that she had difficulty with this process, as you would imagine.
Lawrence Fishburne, though, he said once he read the script, he didn't understand why other people found it confusing.
Yeah.
Although he doubted the movie would ever be made because it was so smart. And the studio insisted on a lot of explanatory dialogue. As they described the screenplay as the script that nobody understands. But, you know, in fairness, they were studio execs.
You said it. And just one last kind of hint before I kind of ask you guys about this. In terms of the philosophical side of things, Temet Noshe, the phrase that the oracle points out in the kitchen, was the inscription above the entrance of the Delphic Oracle. The phrase comes from Latin and is translated, as she says, as know thyself, which again feeds into these philosophical themes. And again, I'm just going to throw it open to any of you. Did any of you pick up on any of these philosophical things? I mean, sometimes it's a subconscious thing, but did anything kind of stand out to you when you watched the movie?
It did on certain aspects while I was watching it. Especially when it did come to the Oracle and some of Morpheus's dialogue, which one of them's my favourite line, so I'm not going to say it now.
Okay,
cool. I did get into that. But I was more tickled by things like the Oracle offering Neo a cookie, you know, which in computer terms is kind of funny. So, yeah, it was there.
I forgot to say as well, in terms of kind of one of the philosophical ideas, as well as being a wider concept, the whole idea of like, is there such thing as fate and free will? I genuinely love that moment when she's like, sorry about the vase, and he breaks it. And then she says, what's really going to bake a noodle later is, would you still have broken it if I hadn't said anything? Which really does, when you think about it, it's like head exploding thoughts.
DK's already covered what I was going to say about, would you have still done, would you have still knocked it over the vase if I hadn't said anything,
Yeah. That was me.
Yeah.
No, it was me, but I mean, the film, it's all about kind of the two-pronged choices. And I mean, not just the obvious ones, the red pill and the blue pill. When you watch it back with that in mind, it comes up all the time, whether it's Smith saying, oh, you have a choice, Mr. Anderson, and one of these two lives has a future, and there are two ways off this building, either that scaffolding or in their custody. And like, the character of Neo makes about like 20 choices throughout the
movie. You can go down that road, Neo, but you've been down that road before.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like I said, once you look out for it, it's kind of amazing how many times, you know, things could have went one way. And like I said, it's this fork in the road idea and making the choice, which again feeds into the idea of Neo even saying, like, I don't believe in fate because I want to be in control of my own destiny, you know. Despite the fact that the film itself seems to be quite ambiguous about the idea of fate, because you also have scenes like when Cypher is going to unplug Neo and says, oh, I couldn't possibly do this if he's the one. And then that's the moment that the surviving tank kind of pulls up and kills him effectively. And it's kind of like, oh, was that a miracle? Was it coincidence? And the film doesn't answer the question, obviously, but it's an amazing kind of like, wow, okay, that's where we're going with this. And then obviously when we get to the end with Neo inside of the Matrix and his absolute kind of savior complex, I guess. Cool. Any last thoughts then? Can I start talking about the religious themes and symbolism, of which there's a lot?
you go for it, dude.
Well, just to kind of give you some background on the things in the film, the name of Morpheus's ship, the Nebuchadnezzar, is a biblical reference to King Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon from the Book of Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar the Great was famous for his conquest of Israel in biblical times, specifically Judah and Jerusalem. He also built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the lost seven wonders of the ancient world, for his wife. He has a dream he can't interpret, but keeps searching for an answer, which reflects the search for answers those who wish to escape the Matrix pursue, and which Morpheus and his crew attempt to provide after freeing their minds. As if you didn't pick up on some of the religious things, early on the film makes it very explicit when Choi tells Neo, "Hallelujah, you're my savior, man, my own personal Jesus Christ." And yeah, I mean, Neo is the most obvious Christ parallel, the idea of the one, the person that was prophesied to save us, the one who dies and comes back to life. The subtext is text, let's be fair here on this one.
Warner Brothers Jesus.
I am Warner Brothers Jesus. But yeah, the question of whether he is the one reflects the question of whether Christ is truly the Messiah, which is, of course, debated in various religions. In both cases, it was foretold, of course. Furthermore, his last name in the real world, Anderson, etymologically means son of man, a biblical phrase referring to Christ. Like Christ, he is, as I said, declared dead and resurrects. Was there anything that any of you picked up on or anything that kind of stood out to you, apart from, like I said, probably the very obvious, like, yeah, Neo is Christ idea?
Well, not to mention that the promised land for them is Zion.
Yes. Yes, I completely forgot that. Absolutely. Thanks for that. Yeah, completely. Yeah. So, I mean, was that something that you were aware of at the time, or is that another thing that's kind of like, it's just a layer the movie works on that it doesn't need to be overtly said, really?
That stood out straight away, and I was brought up as a Catholic, but I'm aware of various other religions and, you know, the holy places of different religions. So hearing Zion, it was like, okay, right?
Yeah, exactly. Fair enough. Cool. Anything from you, Glenn, about the religious stuff? Anything stand out?
Not really. It was so well written. Everything just flowed so naturally. All the exposition just flowed so wonderfully. It was like listening to a poem half the time Morpheus was talking. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like, I didn't really concentrate on that. I just went along with the flow. On previous, yeah. And you've rewatched it several times, you start to pick up on stuff like that. But it's just such a well-written, paced film that it just flows. So I didn't really look too deeply into any kind of like religious meanings, apart from, as you said, the spoon boy, because he's so obviously a little Buddha.
Yeah. Yeah, so, a little buddy.
Little buddy.
Is anyone else picturing Buddy Christ from the Kevin Smith film? Buddy Buddha.
You could market that and make a fortune.
Absolutely could.
But yeah, that was the only thing that really stood out as a reference to Buddhism. But I just love the way it just flowed. So it felt like, I don't know, what, poem, a prayer. It just unraveled beautifully. So I didn't look too deeply.
Things, it's a rare film that I think you can watch, you know, brain disengaged and enjoy it as an action movie. And you can watch it and look for deeper things. And there's so much there. It's so dense. I actually read, there's an introduction on the 4K, probably on the Blu-ray as well, that I was watching this on, rewatching.
By the way, audience.
Shush. It's a written introduction by the Wachowskis where they kind of address why they don't talk much about the film. And in it, they kind of say that the genesis of the film came about when they were just sat one day watching kind of movies and stuff and said, why is it that action movies never ask you any questions of you, and movies that ask questions of you never have any good action? And that they wanted to create something that would be a kind of mixture of both. And I would say, like, mission accomplished, basically. You know?
Yeah, I've got a quote here. It says, absolutely. They wanted to break the mold of action movies being idealist and idea movies being actionless.
That's the one. That's what's on the written introduction. Yeah. Absolutely
perfect. Yeah.
It's just so good. But yeah, I mean, I won't get into too much more. Like, there's way more we could talk about, but in terms of other influences, if you are interested, the film borrows from mythological elements, everything from kind of Joseph Campbell's, you know, hero myth with Neo, to the ideas of things like superhero movies, manga and anime, as DK said. And I'm sure we could all sit here and list several other things, but for a more in-depth exploration, I would certainly recommend seeking out the many things that have been written and said about The Matrix over the years. And if I can just give a very quick plug to the book that helped me through my dissertation, if you're able to find it, it's a book called Exploring the Matrix, New Writings on the Matrix and the Cyber Present. And it is edited by Karen Haber, but written by a bunch of people who write essays on the Matrix. It is an old fashioned book. I think it was written just before Matrix Reloaded. So there is some misgendering in here and a lot of stuff that happened before the sequels that they allude to might be where the story goes, that it does in some cases and doesn't in others, but it's a really good book for exploring all of the various things in it. So before I move to the acting, does anyone have anything else they wanted to add about the various bits of writing and plot of the film?
I also want to give a shout out to a book which I've enjoyed, The Matrix Unlocked, which is an authorized review of the Matrix phenomenon by my good late friend, Mr. Paul Condon.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, thank you for that. Awesome. That's great. I will check that one out. Anything from our guests on the writing and the plot?
No, nothing further.
Just that it's, No, it's just that it's such a, it just works. The whole thing from beginning to end just works. Never slows down, never kind of, you're never bored. It's just such an incredibly good film.
Awesome. Yeah. So moving on then to the acting, just because it's the next thing that I've got written. I'll try not to trample over you this time, DK, and I'll ask you first. Did you have anything on the acting that you wanted to say before we jump in?
Oh, I've got so much here. In 96, the Wachowskis picked the role of Neo to Will Smith. Smith explained on his YouTube channel that the idea was for him to be Neo, while Morpheus was to be played by Val Kilmer. He later explains that he didn't quite understand the concept, and he turned down the role to instead, and get this, film Wild Wild West.
Yes.
Smith claims he was not mature enough as an actor, and that if given the role, he would have messed it up. So, you know, kudos to him for that. He had no regrets, saying that Keanu was brilliant as Neo. Ewan McGregor also turned down the role, with the final two names in the running being Johnny Depp and Reeves. Now, Sandra Bullock was offered the role of Trinity, but turned it down because Will Smith was in the film at that point. I don't know what was going on there, but there you go.
I didn't know that. Wow. Gossip. Yeah.
Gillian Anderson and Jennifer Beals also turned down that role. To prepare for the scene where Neo wakes up in a pod, Reeves lost 15 pounds and shaved his whole body to give Neo an emaciated look. Carrie Ann Moss performed the shots featuring Trinity at the beginning of the film and all the wire stunts throughout herself. She said that after the film's release, she could not go out wearing sunglasses as she was instantly recognised. And when she saw the first cut, it was the first time she'd seen herself in an actual movie.
I mean, I don't really have much to add. Obviously, in terms of Keanu Reeves, somebody has noted that before his character's final speech at the end, Reeves never has more than 5 sentences in a row. Some would argue that's quite fitting for that actor. Neo's transformation from every man hacker to the one is central to the film, and Reeves' portrayal became emblematic. His deadpan delivery and physicality perfectly fit the role. I would agree with that. I think it's, I can't imagine anybody else in the role now. When asked about the film, Carrie Ann Moss just said that she had no career before it, none. And she's eminently grateful to it. In terms of Larry Fishburne, he said that Morpheus to him serves as a mentor and a prophet, guiding Neo with a sense of gravitas that is designed to anchor the film's more abstract ideas. He was told, apparently, to act like the character Dream from Neil Gaiman's Sandman comics. So, make of that what you will. Hugo Weaving says he really enjoyed playing his part, something that Glenn can probably relate to.
Absolutely.
He deliberately made his accent as neutral as he possibly could, and his monotonous delivery was designed to sort of reinforce the machine robot concept. And again, I think we can all agree, pretty effective. One of the better, you know, performances at being sinister and really selling that idea. Mm-hmm. Not really much else to say, except that, you know, obviously the rest of the crew, we don't know most of them. A lot of them were actors that were jobbing in Australia at the time, as that's where The Matrix was filmed. So you may have seen Matt Doran, who plays, what's his name, Mouse. He was initially famous for a recurring role in Home and Away that I recall when I was younger. And he also plays the brilliantly named Sleaze Bagano, the man who offers death sticks in Star Wars Episode 2.
You want to go home and rethink your life.
Sleaze Bagano. I mean, George Lucas, come on. And Ada Nicodemu, who plays Dujour, the Alice's White Rabbit reference girl, was previously in, I think, Neighbours, and definitely was in Heartbreak High and various other Australian things. Notably, numerous sets of identical twins were cast as extras in the Woman in Red scene to create the illusion of a repeating training program made with limited resources. For example, the tall man with slick back hair and sunglasses in the opening shot is seen a few seconds later as a police officer writing a parking ticket, which I didn't know, but really adds to the kind of trippy, you know, unsettling nature of that scene when you realize it's like repeating code, I guess, that there are people in various roles. And one last thing, if you did not know this, Keanu Reeves' stunt double in this film was a guy called Chad Stahelski. If that name is familiar to you, and it might well be, it's because he co-directed John Wick and solo-directed John Wicks 2, 3, and 4. So there you go. When filming the scene when Neo slammed Smith, he sustained several injuries, including broken ribs, knees, and a dislocated shoulder. Another stuntman was injured by a hydraulic puller during a shot in which Neo was slammed into a booth. So not without danger, I think, in terms of the film. And in terms of in our, you know, editorializing, I don't really have much to say, except I love all the performances in this film. So I'm going to go around and ask what you guys think, and if there's a standout kind of performance that really, other than obviously Glenn and Hugo Weaving, I think we can kind of safely tick that one off the list. Yeah,
I was waiting for that. Do I really need to say anything else? The guy's absolutely really. Perfect.
Yeah, it is great. Yeah. Anyone else stand up to anyone? And any thoughts on the acting?
I've got to give a shout out to Joey Pants. I love his portrayal of Cypher. I mean, I think he's a great actor anyway, but he is a villain. Superb. But I kind of appreciate where he comes from, because, you know, not to the point where he's killing everyone left, right, and center. But, you know, being plugged back in.
I don't know.
Because if I had to eat that slop and then said, yeah, look at that steak, I'd be, yeah, plug me the fuck back in, dude.
Yep.
So you're all absolutely. The Judas in the story.
Yep. Plug me straight back in.
Yeah.
I like that character exists as a kind of counterpoint to the, like, you know, would you want to be free? And his idea of, like, Morpheus lied to us is a very interesting one to explore. But like you said, Joe Pantoliano, or Joey Pants, is just a good actor. So he sells that really well. Of course, he got the role because he'd worked with the Wachowskis on Bound, I believe, previously.
Yeah.
That's why he's a rare non-Australian actor. Cool. What about you, Angela? Does anybody stand out for you? I know you're probably a bit of a Keanu fan from Bill and Ted.
Keanu, I'd previously, as I said, only seen in Bill and Ted. And with The Matrix, you could see him evolving as an actor, taking on more adult roles, as it were, you know, more complex roles, which has obviously led to him doing things like John Wick more recently. So it was great to see his evolution, you know, in acting. Lawrence Fishburne, of course, was just incredible as Morpheus, you know, the gravitas that he had.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, also Hugo Weaving, I must admit, I just loved his delivery of his lines. The like you say, the way he sort of emulates a robotic monotony. It was just really well executed, and you know, he had got this quiet menace about him.
Yeah, Which you can tell it's a good performance because it's one of those things that was being copied in, like, you know, offices and schoolyards for years later. I think when this movie and the sequels came out, so many people were going around going like, Mr. Anderson.
You know, not to mention Spaced, Series 2, Episode 1.
Oh, that is so good, yes. I love Spaced, absolutely. Yeah. Right, shall I move us to the directing then?
Yeah, go for it.
Do you have anything on that, DK, before I jump in?
I'm sure I do. The Wachowskis, they storyboarded the entire film before production. According to set decorator Tim Ferrier, the project was visually the most well-prepared show he'd ever worked on. And when studio execs were unhappy with how the production was moving along and threatened to intervene during filming, the Wachowskis and editor hastily compiled the opening scene and finished it with temporary sound and visual effects. The result was enough to keep the studio off their back for the rest of the shoot. All the scenes that take place within the Matrix have a green tint, as if watching them through a computer monitor. Scenes in the real world have a blue tint. Blue was also used at a minimum within the Matrix, since the directors thought blue was more of a real-world colour, despite, ironically, blue being often the least occurring colour in nature. And the fight scene between Morpheus and Neo, which is neither in the real world nor in the Matrix, is tinted yellow. And after the lobby shootout, the camera pans back, showing the aftermath. A moment passes, and then a large chunk of one of the pillars falls off. That wasn't planned. That just happened, and they just left it in for effect.
Yeah. Awesome. I didn't realize as well until watching this for this rewatch. There's a kind of a nice John Woo-esque moment that I've never really picked up on before in the subway fight, when they're kind of standing facing off and then what looks like a piece of trash or something just blows, you know, just flutters away into the. Or it's kind of, I suppose it's kind of a John Woo, but it's also like a Western standoff illusion, like the tumbleweed, you know, before the shootout or whatever. Mirrors appear frequently in the film, like the reflections of the blue and red pills seen in Morpheus's glasses. Excuse me. Neo's capture by agents is viewed through the rearview mirror of Trinity's motorbike. Neo observes a broken mirror mending itself. Reflections warp as the spoon is bent. The reflection of a helicopter visible as it approaches a skyscraper. There's lots more of these. The film's structure emphasizes the duality between the real world as gritty and desolate and the Matrix as sleek and deceptive. And the scene that we've kind of mentioned a couple of times where Neo ends up sans mouth is a reference to, I think, Harlan Ellison's "I Have No Mouth Yet I Must Scream," a bit of a sci-fi staple. So, that's all I have on the direction before we talk about what we liked. So I'm going to throw it again open to our guests here. Did you have anything that stood out in the direction by the Wachowskis here, other than groundbreaking effects and things, I guess?
I can tell you one scene I didn't like at the time, and I still don't like after I've just rewatched it. In the opening scene when they're chasing Trinity and she jumps off that roof and she does that spiral spin.
Yeah, that's the one scene that looks
horrendous. It looks so bad. Everything else looks so good, but that scene is awful.
I thought the same thing, and it's the only time, like, as if she's almost flying, as you're saying, and
kind
of break through the window, but it doesn't really work. It's so weird.
No, that weird spire with the back projection, it looks so tacky, when everything else looks so good.
I can forgive it, because the whole point is it's not real anyways. it's a fake world. Well,
if you want to start, everything's not real. But as you probably know from previous podcasts, I love design work. And the design of the Sentinels and the design of the Nebuchadnezzar and the whole battery, the human field of batteries, just that, just those three designs, incredible, absolutely incredible.
I'm glad you said that.
Those Sentinels are just stunning pieces of work. Whoever came up with the original design for the Sentinels, wow.
Yeah, I don't actually know that, but I agree. I never really realized how much I appreciated the Nebuchadnezzar and the look of those ships. And then I got an email from the place I buy all my Star Trek ships and stuff from that they're making a model of the Nebuchadnezzar that they're selling. But it's like 200 quid. And I'm just like, but it looks so...
Save up. Save up for it. Sell something. Sell some blood. Sell a kidney. buy that model. It is beautiful.
So yeah, cool. Yeah, those sci-fi elements are really good, as you said. The nightmarishness of the, you know, when he wakes up in his pod, Neo, when you see the battery farm of humans and the red goop, and it's horrifying. Incredible. In the worst way.
With that, it is. When that scene kind of... as well, where it's got the pickers basically walking up and down, and they look like tripods from War of the Worlds, and that.
And a lot of kind of, I don't know if it's deliberate, but a lot of kind of bug imagery. A lot of the stuff looks like spiders and mosquitoes, and even the Sentinels are kind of you know, bugs, squid-like. You know? So, I think that's because in my mind, that was maybe because we have a natural revulsion against those things. So making the machines look like revolting to us, I think emphasizes in very quick visual language, like, oh, we don't like
anything,
that.
Anything with more than four legs, yeah. Anything with more than four legs, you start to get squeamish about. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool. Awesome. Did anything stand out to you, Angela? Do you have a favorite kind of bit of the direction? Or?
Again, it's when you go back to the Nebuchadnezzar, the look of the ship, because so many sci-fi shows and films, all the ships are gleaming, pristine, vessels, and when you look at ships, you know, current levels of ships and planes and things, it is just all bare metal. You know, you see the inner workings on a lot of the ships and things that you go on now. So for them to sort of transpose that into the future, where you've just got the bare bones of the ship, that's made it more realistic to me than a lot of the more pristine plasticky type vessels that you see on a lot of shows. And the way that they also shot the interactions between the crew, it was almost like you were actually there, you know, in the ship with them. You know, you could just be sitting there, just taking part in the conversation, watching the back and forth, you know, very sort of an intimate feel to it.
Yeah, I guess, but also on the level of, you can appreciate, I think, as DK and Glenn was saying, you can appreciate where Cypher's coming from, because it doesn't seem like a very pleasant place to be a lot of the time as well. Because, like you said, it's not, you're not on the Starship Enterprise, you're in this rickety, you know, pieced together hovercraft with bits of technology that you're a bit skeptical of anyway. And you can see the inner workings. And I personally love as well that it has what I assume are the EMP emitters or whatever, the circular things all over it that move around on the ship, which to me, I think, echoes the kind of holes in the people that are plugged into the pods. It seemed like a deliberate design choice to me. It could just be a coincidence. But yeah, I just, all that imagery was so good. DK, you've been very quiet. What about you in the direction?
I have to give a shout out to the action sequences in this. I mean, obviously the visual effects help it, but some of the direction where, you know, where especially from the rescuing Morpheus onwards, I think it's just beautiful, at the risk of, you know, coming across like some kind of red hat wearing doofus. It's just beautiful where, you know, the helicopter drops down and it's raining bullets, and then the section where the helicopter's going down and Neo's wrapping his arm around. I just think it's completely beautiful, and I think they really did reach the pinnacle with this directing of their career, because let's be honest, the films that they've done since, they don't even come close to this.
I totally agree with what you were saying, though. I think a lot of people make a big deal about how Tarantino takes these influences from other films and creates this great thing, and I think the Wachowskis don't get credit for taking like Eastern cinema, like Asian, you know, Hong Kong action cinema and stuff, bringing it into this very Western action film and being quite respectful to it. And like you said, hiring Yen Woping as the kind of choreographer of it, the Wire Fu worker and everything. So
they don't get the respect that I think they deserve for bringing it into this kind of hemisphere, as it were.
But yeah, moving on to the visual effects production design, like I said, kind of linked to the direction. The film pioneered, as we've already said, a whole fashion style and a subculture, both of its own and in conjunction with similar things like vampire films and TV, virtual reality, fetish culture, etc., that were all kind of gathering mainstream success in the 90s. The Wachowskis hired underground comic book artists Jeff Darrow and Steve Scroach, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, to draw a 600-page shot-by-shot storyboard, as DK mentioned, for the entire film, which eventually earned the studio's approval. And in the film, the code that composes the Matrix itself, which is referred to as Digital Rain and is echoed by the real rain that we see, particularly in the scene when Neo has to make a choice in the car, is frequently represented as downward flowing green characters. This code uses a custom typeface designed by Simon Whiteley, which includes mirror images of half-width Kana characters. and Western Latin letters and Arabic numerals. In a 2017 interview at CNET, he attributed the design to his wife, who was from Japan, hence the corner.
Oh, you bastard! And added, I had this one.
And added, I like to tell everybody that the Matrix code is made out of Japanese sushi recipes. The color green represents the green tint commonly used on early monochrome computer monitors, and the portrayal resembles the opening credits of the 1995 Japanese cyberpunk film Ghost in the Shell, which has a strong influence on the Matrix, and which we may be reviewing on the podcast in coming months. So, DK, did I just completely step on you there?
No, you took my most enjoyable one, you little shit. It was shot almost entirely in Sydney, Australia. Location scouts found it very difficult to find rundown American-looking locations, so many of the urban decay locations had to be created from scratch. By filming in Australia, the filmmakers kept the final budget at $60 million. The movie would not have been greenlit by Warner Brothers otherwise, because it would have cost a record $180 million for a US-based production. Weirdly enough, though, and you'll appreciate this, Glenn, the rooftop set that Trinity uses to escape from Agent...
You took mine!
From one of the agents before she did that lovely little spin. It was left over from the production of Dark City.
So, oh, Dark City. Oh, beautiful film.
And, this comes back to the earlier references. According to the inscription on the Nebuchadnezzar's court, the ship was made in the USA in the year 2069. Dudes. It also states that it is a Mark III number 11 model, which is a possible reference to Mark 311, which reads, "And whenever those possessed by evil spirits caught sight of him, they would fall down in front of him, shrieking, 'You are the Son of God.'"
There we go. Yeah.
Very nice.
By the way, who's manufacturing these perfect looking plaques and things for the ships when we can barely scrounge together food or anything? Not really a priority, but all right, whatever. that's cool. I mean, I'm not really particularly one who knows that much about production design or the inner workings, so I'm going to throw it open in case either of our guests are particularly au fait with any of that and ask if there's any of the production elements that stand out to you.
That's just most of the set designs.
Or you go first, Glenn.
Oh, it's just basically how everything just looks so functional, so realistic. Mm. The ship itself, the interior of the ship is just like a functioning vessel. Everything looks like it works. It's not far-fetched. It looks like they've cobbled it together from a scrapyard. Just nothing looks cheap. As you said, they kept the budget so far under what it could have been on an American stage, yet the craftspeople built, as you said, the dojo scene. To scratch build something like that was beautiful. Again, such wonderful design work. It doesn't look cheap. Everything just looks so good. To come under budget like that, or to a very limited budget, just incredible.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's very slick, the entire production. To say that they had a relatively limited budget, it looks like a really expensive film. Mm. It's just so really well put together. I loved all the fight scenes as well, especially the one in the lobby.
Yeah. I forgot to say as well, though, but just before we move on, that I'll be honest, I'm always slightly uneasy with the lobby sequence. Not just because of, like, you know, real world happenings of people walking in and shooting up a place, but just because, like, all the people there are kind of innocent. Like, I know the film addresses it, like, now, but anyone's a potential agent and they're all our enemies and they're too connected to really ever unplug and they'll defend this system. But I'm kind of like, oh, but they don't know. You could have freed them first. But again, that's probably the point, you know, the morality.
Well, they kind of get around that earlier on by saying after a certain age, it's too dangerous to free people. So I think that's a kind of a big problem. And I think it's taken some of the luster off the movie for me personally, because a lot of it's been misrepresented and been co-opted by idiots, and it's been used for conspiracy theories ad absurdum. And it's taken what was a great film and kind of marred it slightly for me.
Yeah, just changing the meaning of, like, to be red-pilled and stuff, as you say, co-opting that is bad enough. But then, Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, guns, lots of guns is a really cool line until you put it into real world context and think, ooh, that's not great.
Yeah. But then when you, you know, I mean, yeah, you look at the identity thing, but when you look at it, it's a real world simulation. And the number of fucking asshats that I've seen online that posit this as an actual occurrence, and you just think, it just reminds me of too many idiots now. And I think that's the problem.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. But, you know, you can, you can, you know, disassociate enough, I think, to appreciate the film for what it is as a work of fiction. Yeah. But, yeah, in the real world, there are a lot of people that certainly misunderstand. Like I said, there are people that still argue with the people that made the film that it is not an allegory for what they say it is, despite the fact that they made the bloody thing. So, you know, no, it's not a trans allegory. Well, we wrote it and we say it is. No, it's not, though. Okay? Whatever. You know. Anyway. I'm going to move us to the music and sound. And DK, I'm going to come to you then, just so I don't step on you again.
Well, I've not really got much on this because I know someone in this little recording that's going to have something to say. But Don Davis, I think he does an excellent soundtrack. That aside, I mean, there's some very recognizable motifs here that, you know, you can play them out of context these days, and most people will still know where it's from, you know, the opening chords, where it's going through the text. I mean, Don Davis, and again, I think he's an underappreciated composer because, you know, he never reached that height of Horner or Goldsmith, but, you know, it's instantly recognizable as a soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear the lobby shootout, you know, pounding music in my head. Well,
that's actually Propellerhead Spy Break.
Oh, okay.
Which brings me to the actual licensed music. And oh my god, there's so much good licensed music in this. I mean, weirdly enough, though, the song that Neo's listening to when Trinity contacts him, it's called Dissolve Girl by Massive Attack. It was the first song in the movie, part of a significant scene. And yet not on the soundtrack.
I read that.
But it's such a good soundtrack. It introduced me to quite a few artists. I love Club to Death, which turned out by Rob Duggan, who did music for the sequels, and his album Furious Angels is just chef's kiss. And it also introduced me to a certain band, and I'm now going to hand over to Angela.
And that certain band would be one of my current favourites, Rammstein.
Of course.
The song Du Hast appears on that. And if you don't know any other Rammstein songs, as soon as you hear that one, you'll go like, oh, yes, that's the one that's on The Matrix. But, yeah, there's other great acts on the soundtrack, like DK mentioned, Propellerhead. So, of course, there's Rob Zombie doing Dracula.
So, yes.
Yeah, it's an all-round amazing soundtrack, and I do have a copy on hard, you know, hard copy, not a download.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. I have basically the same information, except a little bit, just to elaborate a little bit on the actual composing side of things. Don Davis focused on the theme of reflections when creating his score, which I mentioned during the direction, the whole mirrors and reflections thing. He alternated between sections of the orchestra and attempting to incorporate contrapuntal ideas. There's a big word for you. Davis's score combines orchestral, choral, and synthesizer elements. The balance between these varies depending on whether humans or machines are the dominant subject of any given scene. And as you mentioned, in addition to Davis's score, the film features music from acts like Rammstein, Rob Duggan, Rage Against the Machine, Propellerheads, Ministry, Lunatic Calm, Deftones, Monster Magnet, The Prodigy, Rob Zombie, Meat Beat, Manifesto, and unfortunately, Marilyn Manson. So there we go. Any other thoughts on the soundtrack? It's not something, again, I'm all that all fear with, but I kind of appreciate it. There's one of those things where I'll probably, if I hear the song now, I'll associate it with the scene from The Matrix, like you mentioned. That is a Propellerheads track. I'll only if I hear that now think of The Matrix lobby shootout scene.
It's one of the great, like, late 90s soundtracks. I can't think of many others that kind of hold up alongside it, if I'm being completely honest.
Right. So I think that kind of deals with most of the film. We're not going to go through a plot synopsis, but it is a great film plot-wise, so do go and watch it if you haven't, as I said. And we're going to jump into our little praise section, hopefully, here, and give our favourite character moment and line from the film, as we always do on my podcasts here. So first of all, favourite character. And I'm going to go around starting with you, Glenn, and ask you who your favourite character was and why.
do you really need me to say anything? Agent Smith. Agent Smith, of course, my favourite character. Gets all the best lines, as most villains do.
That's kind of
no. True, I think Smith is just a wonderful creation. He's got no wasted dialogue. Everything that comes out of his mouth is golden. He's such a calm and cool character, but towards the end, he gets more and more human. He gets angrier and angrier. He starts to act. His face goes from blank to snarling to absolute anger when he's not getting his own way. When he feels like he's, you know, suddenly the fighting back. This shouldn't happen. I should just walk all, you know, the human. I should have absolutely no problem with these guys whatsoever. And he gets more and more frustrated. And Hugo Weaving's kind of like normal, emotionless face becomes a snarling, angry animal, especially towards the end. You know, Neo breaks his sunglasses. He doesn't like that. He gets very angry when his sunglasses
get broken. He's going to enjoy killing you, Mr. Anderson.
Yes, exactly. It's just, my favorite character, definitely Agent Smith, Hugo Weaving. Just incredible.
Cool. Fair enough. What about you then, Angela?
To be honest, I'd have to agree with Glenn. Agent Smith is definitely the most engaging character, I think.
Yep.
The whole movie, with definitely a lot of the best lines in there.
Okay.
Hard for me to just pick one out.
Yeah, that's fair. We'll come to that later anyway. So, GK, what about your favourite character in the movie?
I'm going to have to go against type here and say Neo.
Thank God.
You thought we were all a bunch of bastards. I think we all, to some extent, kind of believe the world around us isn't quite right and, you know, dream of finding a deeper meaning. And I think in that respect, he's a terrific audience surrogate.
Mm-hmm. I'm relieved to hear you say it. I said Neo as well, and I just summed it up very quickly in one sentence. He goes from relatable everyman to wish fulfillment fantasy. So that's why. So what was your favourite scene, Glenn, in the movie or moment?
Not to quote the, you know, the regular kind of like scenes, the, you know, I know Kung Fu and, you know, the lobby shootout. DK mentioned probably one of the most outstanding scene is the rescue of Morpheus. When the Huey comes down, Neo opens up with the minigun, shreds the whole place. The sprinklers are coming on. And there's, when Morpheus gets out of his chair and is running and one of the bullets hits his leg, the blood explodes into the water. And you can see this red mist around his leg in slow motion, which I thought was an incredible piece of detail. Just wonderful. But I also love the restaurant scene with Cypher and Smith when Cypher's just wanting to get back in. Please plug me back in. When he's chewing ignorance the steak, which is ignorance definitely is bliss. And of course, when he's interrogating Morpheus, when he's talking about how humanity is a virus and a cancer, and basically animals learn to adapt and learn to live in harmony with the surroundings, where we just come in, procreate, build, move on to the next patch, do the exact same again and again and again. Yeah. And basically anything that features Smith.
See, when it comes to the Agent Smith character, I'm basically with Neo. How about I give you the finger and you give me my phone?
look what happened to Neo after that.
I don't want to lose my mouth, obviously.
The listeners are going, oh, please, God.
I was just going to say that, yeah. Thanks for jumping in on that one for me, DK. Angela, what about you? Who was your favourite moment or scene in the film?
There's a couple of ones that I really like. Obviously, there's where Neo's fighting with Agent Smith and there's bullets flying and then he's bending over backwards. So in the way they shot that was absolutely fantastic. But also in the dojo, just when Morpheus is giving Neo the come on, just that double flick.
A little Bruce Lee kind of come at me thing.
Yeah.
What about you, DK?
I'm going to have to go. It's hard to narrow it down, but I've got to go with Rescuer Morpheus. And I'm, by that, I generally mean everything from entering the lobby right up to dodge this. Pretty much everything is just the best.
I was going to say more or less the same thing. I was going to say the Rescue of Morpheus, but I know that incorporates a lot. For me, not so much the lobby thing, but everything from, you know, when they start fighting on the rooftop to, you know, crashing the helicopter into the building. But if you need me to narrow it down, then, as I said, that the moment on the rooftop when Neo kind of first hits bullet time when he's fighting with the agent, and you get Trinity even saying, like, how did you do that? You moved like they do. And as you said, dodge this, that fantastic little end moment against the agent. So yeah. I like that. Particular of that, you know, larger scene, that's the microcosm scene that I would pick. And what is your favorite line from the movie, Glenn, if you have one?
Favorite line? I'm never good at remembering lines or quoting them.
There's so many quotable little things, I'm sure you
can. Wait. I'm sorry. It's Smith again.
Go for
it. It's right at the very beginning. When the policeman saying, he said, you shouldn't have sent any men in. And the policeman goes, she's just a little girl. Smith replies with something like, but your men are already dead.
Yeah.
It's just like,
I love that cool scene. He starts off with the sly little dig when he's like, don't give me any of that jurors, my diction crap.
That's it. Yeah.
I think my men can handle one little girl. They're bringing her out now. And then, as you said, the way Smith just coldly says, no, Lieutenant, your men are already dead.
Oh, just beautiful.
Brilliant. Oh, man, I love this movie. Anyway, Angela, can you think of a quote or a line from this movie?
Not off the top of my head. And I've been playing the film, but it's all been on mute. So any of the good quotes I've completely missed as we've been talking.
Then I'm going to assign you the quote, there is no spoon.
Indeed.
What about you, DK?
I've kind of got two, one which is a funny and one which is a more philosophical one. The funny is the little dig at Neo being thick as pudding, where Tank is trying to direct him and he says, go left. No, your other left.
Is that Neo or is that Tank that's being thick in that one? No.
I think that's let's be honest. I don't think he kind of lived down Bill and Ted at that point. So, yeah. But my favorite one is, have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
Yes. See, I love so many of the philosophical and meaningful quotes and so many of the funny quotes, and yet the one that I've picked is the most basic bitch possibility that I could possibly go with. My quote is from Trinity, and it's just, Neo, I'm not afraid anymore. The Oracle told me that I'd fall in love and that man, the man that I loved, would be the one. So you see, you can't be dead. You can't be, because I love you. You hear me? I love you. Now get up. I'm just a sucker for the most blatantly obvious, like, you know, romance subplot in the movie. It's the most basic bitch part of it, but
I'm just like going,
cooties.
DK, were you just sticking your mouth, DK?
Yeah.
Well, that's where we differ. I'm an old romantic, and you, fuck knows.
I'm just an old misanthrope.
Yeah, maybe. And so before we give our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars, we like to, you know, throw things open to you, which we did do. We didn't get a lot of responses, but we have got some from our audience, from our kind of Facebook and Twitter / X / Elon Musk's personal right wing hell. DK, over to you, because you have this.
Yeah, I do. First one up is from John Derling Lennon. He says, I remember how low-key the advertising was for it. What is The Matrix with a date on the side of buses? It blew me away, and same day I saw it, I bought a leather trench coat at Camden Market.
Nice.
Austin Begg said, I thought it was a breath of fresh air. The concepts were not new, obviously explored in previous Hollywood movies such as 2001, ASO, anybody? Space Odyssey, Jesus.
Oh, Space Odyssey.
Yeah. Terminator films, Westworld, etc. And of course the works of William Gibson, Asimov, etc. Where it truly differentiated itself was the infusion of the Hong Kong Kung Fu, Wushu, wire aesthetics and Eastern philosophies. The film itself played like a vivid vivid graphic novel. Only things we had similar to at that point had to have been Blade Runner, Batman 89, The Crow, and Dark City. The latter's after Blade Runner, all drawing influence from Ridley Scott's film, but evolving to add something more. Matrix was accessible, simple to understand, brilliantly visualized, and above all, cool and enjoyable, as one would expect from a crossover between Kung Fu and sci-fi, where the premise that the laws of physics don't apply. Melissa A. Nathan, she says, I rewatched them all when the fourth one came out a couple of years ago, and I don't know why it had been so long since I'd watched them. I rewatched them a couple of months ago again. I like all four of them, but the first is amazing. Eric Manuel says, a classic, love the movie. Rick Cowling says, it's a cracker, but like all films, it's got its flaws. Just on the groundbreaking visuals alone, it deserves high praise. And I've saved the best two till last. David Howland, he says, I've just rewatched all four. Why I watched four, I don't know. He says, one and two is brilliant. Three is a bit of a mess. And four is like a Friends episode with karate. And I've got to leave this one as the last, because I think this is fantastic. Leia Wells says, after watching the first one at the cinema, I went home and set Lightwave to rendering a project for days just to hurt the CPU. That is brilliant.
That is quite brilliant. Anyway, that was brilliant. That was hilarious. Right. So then, as I said, we are going to round up with our conclusions and our scores out of 5 stars from all of us here. And so, yeah, we've been doing it all the way through. So we'll start with you, Glenn. Why not? What is your conclusion if you have one, and a score out of 5?
It's definitely 5. After watching it this morning before coming on here, it's not aged at all. It still looks as good as it did then. How is that possible? It still holds up. Everything about it, it looks like it could have been made yesterday. It's just, how do you make a film that's not dated when it's about technology?
I know, 25 years as well. Such a long time when you think.
It's an incredible feat. To make a look at all the other ones that came out around the same time, or even films that are a couple of years old, they've already started to date, especially science fiction films, anything with effects. But yeah. The Matrix, it's as polished as it ever was. It's just a beautiful film. There's so little wrong with it. It's a joy to watch. Again, you can watch it as many times as you like, always find something different, something you've missed, and still get 100% enjoyment out of it. It's just a groundbreaking, wonderfully made film.
Awesome. So cool. 5 stars from Glenn, yeah. What about you, Angela, then, your conclusion and score, please?
Well, the score, same as Glenn, definitely a 5. Okay. It's so enjoyable on so many different levels. It's great as a science fiction movie, as an action movie. You've got the romance element to it. You've got the whole philosophical undertones. You know, every time you go back and watch it, you can discover something else in there. And as Glenn says, it still holds up even 25 years later. It's just an all-round fantastic film.
Awesome. And it's got Rammstein in, so it was automatically going to win. <Yeah. wasn't it? laughs> Awesome. So, yeah. What about you then, DK, your conclusion and score? You've done this enough times, you know what the drill is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this blew me away in cinemas. It was groundbreaking to see such things in, you know, Western live-action cinema. For a time, I was utterly obsessed with this. Looking back, it still holds up, even if one or two of the effects so unique at the time have long been since beaten to a bloody pulp like the proverbial dead horse. So much of it has been co-opted by a generation of brain-dead conspiracy theorist boomers has also long ago taken the sheen off. However, if you can look past that, there is still a really fantastic movie in here that is not only one of the best science fiction movies in decades, but an amazing exploration into identity and what we interpret as self. The set design, cinematography, and script are on point. And honestly, the Wachowskis have never directed anything better than this. It was backed up by an impressive cast giving great performances and a truly kick-ass soundtrack. it is something special. So for me, while some of it's dated a little in the intervening years and real world assholes have soured the experience a little, it's still an impressive piece of cinema. So I'm going to give it 4.5.
Oh, dick.
I've ruined your plan, Mr. Wilson.
Yes, just a tad. Bear with me one second while I... You're going to make me do calculations. I wasn't going to do... Anyway. You are so wrong about that, by the way. Anyway. So, yeah, my conclusion and score. Maybe one of the densest films we've ever looked at on the podcast. We've been all over the influences, so I won't rehash them. But combining them in this melting pot and making a coherent, interesting, compelling, and instantly iconic story was an act of genius by the Wachowski sisters. There's no question in my mind. Couple that with pioneering, groundbreaking special effects, direction that veers effortlessly between symbolism and action, brilliantly incorporating Asian influence to the hand-to-hand fight scenes as well. I'll be honest, I wasn't as instantly wowed by the film as most were. I think it's a little too dense and it doesn't ease the audience into its world subtly, ironically enough, much like Neo being unplugged. But the more I've studied the film, the more I recognize the brilliance and the more I see in it as well. As a result, you might say I started to believe, and I could then fully enjoy just how entertaining it is also. It's a franchise that I remain fascinated by. I could study it forever, watch, read, or play anything new. And it all started here with the original movie that's, as we've said, never really been improved on. Cinematic and social history that is a heck of a lot more than John Wick doing the limbo under some bullets. Give it 5 out of 5, like all sane people on this podcast. So there we go.
See, Mike, this is me giving you the finger.
And so, yeah, to get our final score, then we add those scores together, multiply by the 4, because there's 4 of us here. And so the final score for The Matrix, thanks to DK, is 4.875 out of 5.
So, come on. Yeah. It's still pretty good.
It's still pretty good, but I mean, come on. It should have been 5. So that concludes another episode of the Silver Screen Podcast. Just remains for me to thank DK, as always, for joining me.
Anytime.
And you can find myself, DK, and the podcast all over the internet, wherever mics and DKs are sold, via the various links that you'll see on screen when I edit the episode, because I always put a little banner up where you can find us all over social media. It's mainly me and the podcast, though DK does occasionally pop in to complain about polls that are happening. If you aren't watching on YouTube, don't worry, the link tree in our episode description will also send you to all the places you can find us. And thanks again to both of our guests for joining us. Thank you, Glenn.
Oh, thank you so much. It's again been a wonderful experience. I've loved every second. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to hear it. And do you have anywhere people can find you on the internet? Anything you want to plug?
Just on Facebook. Yeah, just Facebook. Yep.
And that's just Glenn Brooks, I assume.
just me.
Cool. And thanks again, Angela, for coming back and joining us. And hopefully you've had a good time as well.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me back.
Awesome. Do you have anything you want to plug or anywhere people can find you?
For those of you out there that are Rammstein fans, you can find me on X or Twitter, as I prefer to call it. Instagram, Tumblr, various places. I'll give you all the links later on. I'm sure you can post them up.
I'll pop them in the description. Absolutely. Yeah. Cool. Awesome. So, yeah, hopefully we've woken you from your sleep of servitude, some of you, and opened your eyes, maybe for the first time. So, yeah, I'm signing out. And until next time, we'll be back with more. But in the meanwhile, I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice that I leave to you.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Cut!